Carriages were thickly parked outside Lady Zalachi's mansion when Corporal Knobs strolled up the drive. He knocked on the door. A footman opened it. "Servant's entrance," said the footman, and made to shut the door again. But Nobby's outstretched foot had been ready for this. "Read these," he said, thrusting two bits of paper at him. The first one read, "Hi, after hearing evidence from a number of experts, including Mrs. Slipdry, the midwife, certify that the balance of probability is that the bearer of this document, C.W. St. John Knobs, is a human being. Signed, Lord Veterinary." The other was the letter from Dragon King of Arms. The footman's eyes widened. "Oh, I am terribly sorry, your lordship," he said. He stared again at Corporal Knobs. Nobby was clean-shaven, as at least the last time he'd shaved, he'd been clean-shaven. But his face had so many minor topological features, it looked like a very bad example of slash-and-burn agriculture. "Oh dear," added the footman. He pulled himself together. "The other visitors normally just have cards." Nobby produced a battered deck. I'm probably busy hobnobbing right now," he said. "But I'm game for a few rounds of Cripple Mr. Onion afterward, if you like." The footman looked him up and down. He didn't get out much. He'd heard rumors. Who hadn't? The working in the watch was the rightful king of Ankh-Morpork. He'd have to admit that if you wanted to hide a secret heir to the throne, you couldn't possibly hide him more carefully than under the face of C.W. St. J. Knobs. On the other hand, the footman was something of an historian and knew then in its long history, even the throne itself had been occupied by creatures who had been hunchbacked, one-eyed, knuckle-dragging, and as ugly as sin. On that basis, Nobby was as royal as they came. If technically, he wasn't hunchback, this was only because he was hunched front and sides, too. There might be a time, the footman thought, when it paid to hitch your wagon to a star, even if said star was a red dwarf. "You've never been to one of these affairs before, my lord," he said. "First time," said Nobby. "I'm sure your lordship's blood will rise to the occasion," said the footman weakly. "I'll have to go," Angua thought, as they hurried through the fog. "I can't go on living from month to month." It's not that he's not likable. You couldn't wish to meet a more caring man. That's just it. He cares for everyone. He cares about everything. He cares indiscriminately. He knows everything about everyone because everyone interests him. And the caring is all general and never personal. He doesn't think personal is the same as important. If only he had some decent human quality, like selfishness. I'm sure he doesn't think about it that way. But you can tell the werewolf thing is upsetting him underneath. He cares about the things people say behind my back, and he doesn't know how to deal with them. What was it those dwarfs said the other day? One said something like, "She feels the need," and the other one said, "Yeah, the need to feed." I saw his expression. I can handle that sort of thing, well, most of the time, but he can't. If only he'd thumped someone, it wouldn't do any good, but at least he'd feel better. It's going to get worse. At best, I'm going to get caught in someone's chicken house, and then the midden is really going to hit the windmill. Or I'll get caught in someone's room. She tried to shut out the thought, but it didn't work. You could only control the werewolf. You couldn't tame it. It's the city. Too many people. Too many smells. Maybe it would work if we were just alone somewhere. But if I said, "It's me or the city," he wouldn't even see that there was a choice. Sooner or later, I've got to go home. It's the best thing for him. Vimes walked through the damp night. He knew he was too angry to think properly. He'd got nowhere, and he'd traveled a long way to get there. He had a cartload of facts, and he'd done all the right logical things, and to someone, somewhere, he must look like a fool. He probably looked like a fool to Carrot already. He'd kept coming up with bright ideas, proper policeman's ideas, and each one had turned out to be a joke. He'd bullied and shouted and done all the proper things, and none of it had worked. They hadn't found a thing. They'd merely increased their amount of ignorance. The ghost of old Mrs. Easy rose up to his inner vision. Up in his inner vision. He couldn't remember much about her. He'd been just another snotty kid in a crowd of snotty kids, and she'd been just another worried face somewhere on top of a penny. One of Cockbill Street's people. She'd taken in needlework to make ends meet and kept up appearances and, like everyone else in the street, had crept through life, never asking for anything and getting even less. What else could he have done? They'd practically scraped the damn wallpaper off the wall. He stopped. There was the same wallpaper in both rooms, in every room on that floor. That horrible green wallpaper. But no, that couldn't be it. Veterinary had slept in that room for years. If he slept at all. You can't sneak in and redecorate without someone noticing. In front of him, the fog rolled aside. He caught a glimpse of a candlelit room in a nearby building. Before the cloud flowed back. Yes, the fog. Yes. Dampness creeping in, brushing against the wallpaper. The old, dusty, musty wallpaper. Would Cheery have tested the wallpaper? After all, in a way, you didn't actually see it. It wasn't in the room, because it was defining what the room was. Could you actually be poisoned by the walls? He hardly dared the thought. If he let his mind settle on the suspicion, it'd twist and fly away like all the others. But this was it, said his secret soul. All the messing around with suspects and clues. That was just something to keep the body amused while the back of the brain toiled away. Every real copper knew you didn't go around looking for clues so that you could find who'd done it. No, you started out with a pretty good idea of who'd done it. That way, you knew what clues to look for. He wasn't going to have to have another day of bafflement interspersed with desperately bright ideas, was he? It was bad enough looking at Corporal Littlebottom's expression, which seemed to be getting a little more colorful every time he saw it. He'd said, "Ah, arsenic's a metal, right? So maybe the cutlery had been made of it." He wouldn't forget the look on the dwarf's face as Cheery tried to explain that yes, it might be possible to do that. Provided you were sure that no one would notice the way it dissolved in the soup almost instantly. This time, he was going to think first. The Earl of Ankh, Corporal the Right Honorable Lord C.W. St. J. Nobbs. The buzz of conversation stopped. Heads turned. Somewhere in the crowd, someone started to laugh and was hurriedly shushed into silence by their neighbors. Lady Salachi came forward. She was a tall, angular woman, with the sharp features and aquiline nose that were the hallmarks of the family. The impression was that an axe was being thrown at you. Then she curtsied. There were gasps of surprise around her. But she glared at the assembled guests, and there was a smattering of bows and curtsies. Somewhere at the back of the room, someone started to say, "But the man's an absolute oik," and was cut off. "Has someone dropped something?" said Navi nervously. "I'll help you look, if you like." The footman appeared at his elbow, bearing a tray. "A drink, my lord," he said. "Yeah, okay, a pint of Winkles," said Navi. Jaws fell, but Lady Salachi rose to the occasion. "Winkles," she said. "A type of beer, your ladyship," said the footman. Her ladyship hesitated only a moment. "I believe the butler drinks beer," she said. "See to it, man. And I'll have a pint of Winkles, too. What a novel idea." This caused a certain effect among those guests who knew on which side of the biscuit their pâté was spread. "Indeed, capital suggestion. A pint of Winkles here, too." "Ha ha, great. Winkles for me. Winkles all around." But the man's an absolute shut up. Vimes crossed the brass bridge with care, counting the hippos. There was a ninth shape, but it was leaning against the parapet and muttering to itself in a familiar and, to Vimes at least, an unmenacing way. Faint air movements wafted toward him, a smell that outsmelled even the river. It proclaimed that ahead of Vimes was a ding-a-ling so big he'd been upgraded to a clang-a-ling. Bugger it, I told him! Stand it up and pull the Endorf. Millennium hand and shrimp, I told him, says I. And would they poke? Evening run, said Vimes, without even bothering to look at the figure. Foul Ron fell into step behind him. Bugger it, they done me out of it, so they did. Yes, Ron, said Vimes. And shrimp, bugger it, say I. Bread it on the butter side. Queen Molly says to watch your back, mister. What was that? Soder fry it, said Foul Old Ron innocently. Trouser the lot of him. They did me out of it, them and their big weasel. The beggar lurched around, and filthy coat dragging its hems along the ground, limped away into the fog. His little dog trotted along in front of him. There was pandemonium in the servants' hall. Winkle's old peculiar, said the butler. Another 144 pints, said the footman. The butler shrugged. Harry, Sid, Rob, and Geoffrey, two trays apiece, and double down to the King's Head again, right now. What else is he doing? Well, they're supposed to be having a poetry reading, but he's telling them jokes. Anecdotes? Not exactly. It was amazing how it could drizzle and fog at the same time. Rain was blowing both through the open window, and Vimes... And Vimes was forced to shut it. He lit the candles by his desk and opened his notebook. Probably he should use the demonic organizer, but he liked to see things written down fair and square. He could think better when he wrote things down. He wrote arsenic and drew a big circle around it. Around the circle he wrote, Father Tubalchuk's fingernails, and rats, and veterinary, and Mrs. Easy. Lower down the page he wrote golems, and drew a second circle. Around that one he wrote Father Tubalchuk, and Mr. Hopkinson. After some thought he wrote down stolen clay, and grog. And then, why would a golem admit to something it didn't do? He stared at the candlelight for a while, and then wrote, Rats eat stuff. More time passed. What has the priest got that anyone wants? From downstairs came the sound of armor as a patrol came in. A corporal shouted. Words, wrote Vimes. What have Mr. Hopkinson's got? Dwarf bread? Not stolen. What else had he got? Vimes looked at this, too, and then he wrote bakery, stared at the word for a while, and rubbed it out and replaced it with oven. He drew a ring around oven and a ring around stolen clay, and linked the two. There had been arsenic under the old priest's fingernails. Perhaps he'd put down rat poison. There were plenty of uses for arsenic. It wasn't as if you couldn't buy it by the pound from any alchemist. He wrote down arsenic monster and looked at it. You found dirt under fingernails. If people had put up a fight, you might find blood or skin. You didn't find grease and arsenic. He looked at the page again, and after still more thought, he wrote, Golems aren't alive, but they think they are alive. What do things that are alive do? Answer. Breathe, eat, crap. He paused, staring out at the fog, and then wrote very carefully, and make more things. Something tingled at the back of his neck. He circled the late Hopkinson's name and drew a line down the page to another circle in which he wrote, He'd got a big oven. Cheery had said you couldn't bake clay properly in a bread oven. But maybe you could bake it improperly. He looked up at the candlelight again. They couldn't do that, could they? Oh, gods. No, surely not. But after all, All you needed was clay, and a holy man who knew how to write the words, and someone to actually sculpt the figure. I am supposed, but golems had had hundreds and hundreds of years to learn to be good with their hands. Those great big hands, the ones that look so very fist-like. And then the first thing they'd want to do would be to destroy the evidence, wouldn't they? They probably didn't think of it as killing, but more like a sort of switching off. He drew another rather misshapen circle on his notes. Grog. Old baked clay, ground up small. They'd added some of their own clay. Dorful had a new foot, didn't he? It hadn't made it quite right. They'd put part of their own selves into a new golem. That all sounded, well, Nobby would call it mucky. Vimes didn't know what to call it. It sounded like some sort of secret society thing. Clay of my clay, my own flesh and blood. Damn hulking things, aping their betters. Vimes yawned. Sleep. He'd be better for some sleep or something. He stared at the page. Automatically, his hand trailed down to the bottom drawer of the desk, as it always did when he was worried and trying to think. It wasn't as though there was ever a bottle there these days, but old habits died hard. There was a soft, glassy ching and a faint, seductive slosh. Vimes' hand came up with a fat bottle. The label said, Bear Hugger's Distilleries, the macabre finest malt. The liquid inside almost crawled up the sides of the glass in anticipation. He stared at it. He'd reached down into the drawer for the whiskey bottle, and there it was. But it shouldn't have been. He knew Carrot and Fred Colton kept an eye on him. But he'd never bought a bottle since he'd got married, because he'd promised Sybil, hadn't he? But this wasn't any old rot gut. This was the macabre. He tried it once. He couldn't quite remember why now, since in those days the only spirits he generally drank had the subtlety of a mallet to the inner ear. He must have found the money somehow. Just a sniff of it had been the Hog's Watch night. Been like Hog's Watch night. Just a sniff. And she said, That's funny. It doesn't do that last night. It didn't do that last night, said Corporal Knobs. He beamed at the company. There was silence. Then someone in the crowd started to laugh. One of those little uncertain laughs. A man laughs who is unsure that he's not going to be silenced by those around him. Another man laughed. Two more picked it up. Then laughter exploded in the group as a whole. Nobby basked. Then there's the one about the Clatchian who walked into a pub with a tiny piano, he began. I think, said Lady Salachi firmly, that the buffet is ready. Got any pig knuckles? Said Nobby cheerfully. Goes down a treat with Winkles, a plate of pig knuckles. I don't normally eat extremities, said Lady Salachi. A pig knuckle sandwich. Never tried a pig knuckle. You just can't beat it, said Nobby. It is perhaps not the most delicate food, said Lady Salachi. Oh, you can cut the crusts off, said Nobby. Even the toenails, if you're feeling posh. Sergeant Colin opened his eyes and groaned. His head ached. They'd hit him with something, and it might have been a wall. They'd tied him up, too. He had trussed hands and foot. He appeared to be lying in darkness on a wooden floor. There was a greasy smell in the air, which seemed familiar yet annoyingly unrecognizable. As his eyes grew accustomed to the dark, he could make out very faint lines of light, such as might surround a door. He could also hear voices. He tried to get up to his knees and groaned as more pain crackled in his head. When people tied you up, it was bad news. Of course, it was much better news than when they killed you, but it could mean they were just putting you on one side for killing later. It's never used to happen, he told himself. In the old days, if you caught someone thieving, you practically held the door open for him to escape. That way, you got home in one piece. By using the angle between a wall and a heavy crate, he managed to get upright. This was not much of an improvement on his former position, but after the thunder in his head had died away, he hopped awkwardly towards the door. There were still voices on the other side of it. Someone apart from Sergeant Cullen was in trouble. Clown, you got me here for this? There's a werewolf in the watch. Aha. Uh-huh. Not one of your freaks. She's a proper biomorphic. If you tossed a coin, she could smell what side it came down. How about if we kill him and drag his body away? You think she couldn't smell the difference between a corpse and a living body? Sergeant Cullen moaned softly. How about we could march him out in the fog? And they can smell fear, idiot. Aha! Why couldn't you have let him look around? What could he have seen? I know that copper, a fat old coward with all the brains of a pig. He stinks of fear all the time. Sergeant Cullen hoped he wasn't about to stink of anything else. Send Mashuga after him. Aha! Are you sure? It's getting odd. It wanders off and screams in the night, and they're not supposed to do that. And it's cracking up. The trust dumb golems not to do something proper. Everyone knows you can't trust golems. Aha! See to it. I heard that Vimes is... I've seen to Vimes. Cullen eased himself away from the door as quietly as possible. He hadn't the faintest idea what this thing called Mashuga the golems had made was. Except that it sounded like a fine idea to be wherever it wasn't. Now, if he were a resourceful type like Sam Vimes or Captain Carrot, he'd find a nail or something to snap these ropes, wouldn't he? They were really tight and cut into his wrist because the cord was so thin. Little more than string, wound and knotted many times. If he could find something to rub it on. But unfortunately, and against all common sense, sometimes people inconsiderately threw their bound enemies into rooms entirely bereft of nails, handy bits of sharp stone, sharp edges of shards of glass, or even, in the extreme cases, enough pieces of old junk and tools to make a fully functional armored car. He managed to get onto his knees again and shuffled across the planks. Even a splinter would do, a lump of metal. A wide-open doorway marked freedom. He'd settle for anything. What he got was a tiny circle of light on the floor. A knothole in the wood had long ago fallen out, and light, dim orange light, was shining through. Cullen got down and applied his eye to the hole. Unfortunately, this also brought his nose into a similar proximity. The stench was appalling. There was a suggestion of wateriness. Or at least liquidity. He must be over one of the numerous streams that flowed through the city, although they had of course been built over centuries before, and were now used, if their existence was even remembered, for those purposes to which humanity had always put clean fresh water, i.e. making it as turbid and undrinkable as possible. And this one was flowing under the cattle markets. The smell of ammonia bored into Cullen's sinuses like a drill. And yet there was light down there. He held his breath and took another look. A couple of feet below him was a very small raft. Half a dozen rats were laid neatly on it, and a minute scrap of candle was burning. A tiny rowing boat entered his vision. A rat was in the bottom of it, and sitting amidships and rowing was Wee Mad Arthur. The gnome looked up. Who's that there, then? It's me, your good old mate Fred Cullen. Can you give me a hand? What are yous doing up there? I'm all tied up, and they're going to kill me. Why does it smell so bad? So the old cockbill stream. All the cattle pens drain into it. Wee Mad Arthur grinned. You just can feel it doing your tubes a power of good, eh? Just call me the king of the Golden River, eh? They're going to kill me, Arthur. Don't piss about. Aha, good one. Desperate cells flared in Colin's mind. I've been on the trail of those blokes who are poisoning rats, he said. The Rat Catcher's Guild, snarled Arthur, almost dropping an oar. I knew it was them, right? This is where I got them rats. There's more of them down here. Dead as doornails, right. And I've got to give the names to Commander Vimes in person. with all my arms and legs on. He's very particular about that sort of thing. Did yous know yous on a trap door? Said Arthur. Wait right there. Arthur rode out of sight. Colin rolled over, and after a while, there was a scratching noise in the walls, and then someone kicked him in the ear. Ow! Would there be any money in this? Said wee Mad Arthur, holding up his stub of candle. It was a small one, such as might be put on a child's birthday cake. What about your public duty? Aye, so there's no money in this. Lots, I promise. Now untie me. This is string they've used, said Arthur, somewhat around Colin's hands. Not proper rope at all. Colin felt his hands free, although there was still pressure around his wrists. Where's the trap door? He said. You're on it. Handy for dumping stuff. Don't look as if it's been used for years. From underneath. Hey, I've been finding dead rats everywhere down there now. Fat as your head, and twice as dead. I thought the ones I caught for a gimlet were a wee bit sluggish. There was a twang, and Cullen's legs were free. He sat up cautiously and tried to massage some life back into them. Is there any other way out? He said. Plenty for me, none for a silly bugger like yous, said wee Mad Arthur. You'll have to swim for it. You want me to drop into that? Don't yous worry, yous can't drown in it. You sure? Yeah, but yous may suffocate. You know that creek they talk about, the one yous can be up without no paddle? That's not this one, is it? Said Colin. It's cause of the cattle pens, said wee Mad Arthur. Cattle pens up and pinned up and always a bit nervous. I know how they feel. There was a creak outside the door. Colin managed to get to his feet. The door opened. A figure filled the doorway. It was in silhouette because of the light behind it, but Colin looked up into two triangular glowing eyes. Colin's body, which in many respects was considerably more intelligent than the mind it had to carry around, took over. It made use of the adrenaline fed start the brain had given, and leapt several feet in the air, pointing its toes as it came down so that the iron tips of Colin's boots hit the trapdoor together. The filth of years and the rust of iron gave way. Colin went through. Fortunately, his body had the foresight to hold its nose as he hit the much maligned stream, which went gloop. Many people, when they're precipitated into water, struggle to breathe. Sergeant Colin struggled not to. The alternative was too horrible to think about. He rose again, buoyed up in part by various grasses released from the ooze. A few feet away, the candle on Wee Mad Arthur's rocking raft started to burn with a blue flame. Someone landed on his helmet and kicked it like a man spurs on a horse. Right turn. Forward. Half waking, half swimming, Colin struggled down the fetid drain. Terror lent him strength. It would demand repayment with interest later, but for now he left awake, which took several seconds to close up after him. He didn't stop until a sudden lack of pressure overhead told him that he was in open air. He grabbed in the darkness, found the greasy pilings of a jetty, clung to them, wheezing. What was that thing? Said Wee Mad Arthur. Gollum, Colin panted. He managed to get a hand on the planks of the jetty, tried to pull himself up, and sagged back into the water. Hey, did I just hear something? Said Wee Mad Arthur. Sergeant Colin rose like an undersea launched missile and landed on the jetty, where he folded up. Nah, just a bird or something, said Wee Mad Arthur. What do your friends call you, Wee Mad Arthur? Muttered Colin. Dunno. Ain't got none. Gosh, that's surprising.
Lord Denobs had a lot of friends now. Up the hatch! Here's looking at you, your bottom, he said. There were shrieks of laughter. Nobby grinned happily in the middle of the crowd. He couldn't remember when he had enjoyed himself so much with all his clothes on.
In the far corner of Lady Solachi's drawing room, a door closed discreetly, and in the comfortable smoking room beyond, anonymous people sat down in leather armchairs and looked at one another expectantly. Finally, one said, "It's astonishing, frankly astonishing. The man has actually got charisma. "Your meaning?" "I mean, he's so dreadful, he fascinates people. Like those stories he was telling. Did you notice how people kept encouraging him because they couldn't actually believe anyone would tell jokes like that in mixed company?" "Actually, I rather liked the one about the very small man playing the piano. And his table manners. Did you notice them?" "No." "Exactly. And the smell. Don't forget the smell. Not so much bad as odd. Actually, I found that after a few minutes, the nose shuts down, my point is that in some strange way, he attracts people. Like a public hanging." There was a period of reflective silence. Good-humored little tit, though, in his way. Not too bright, though. Give him his pint of beer and a plate of whatever those things with toenails were, and he seems as happy as a pig in muck. I think that's somewhat insulting. I'm sorry. I've known some splendid pigs, indeed. But I can certainly see him drinking his beer and eating feet while he signs the royal proclamations. Yes, indeed. Or do you think he can read? Does it matter? There was some more silence, filled with the busy racing of minds. Then someone said, "Another thing. We don't have to worry about establishing a royal succession. That might be inconvenient. Why do you think that?" "Can you see any princess marrying him?" "Well, they have been known to kiss frogs. Frogs, I grant you. And, of course, power and royalty are aphrodisiacs." "How powerful, would you say?" More silence. "Then probably not that powerful. He should do nicely. Splendid. Dragon did well. I suppose the little tit isn't really an earl by any chance. Don't be silly." Sherry Littlebottom sat awkwardly on the high stool behind the desk. All she had to do, she'd been told, was check the patrols off and on duty when the shift changed. A few of the men gave her an odd look, but they said nothing, and she was beginning to relax when the four dwarfs on the Kingsway beat came in. They stared at her and her ears. Their eyes traveled downwards. There was no such concept as a modesty panel in Ankh-Morpork. All that was usually visible under the desk was the bottom half of Sergeant Cullen. Of the large number of good reasons for shielding the bottom half of Sergeant Cullen from view, its potential for engendering lust was not among the top 10. "That's female clothes, isn't it?" said one of the dwarfs. Sherry swallowed. "Why now?" She'd sort of assumed Angle would be around. People always calmed down when she smiled at them. It was really amazing. "Well," she quavered, "so what? I can if I want to. And on your ear?" "Well, that's my mother never even, that's disgusting. In public, too. What happens if kids come in?" "I can see your ankles," said another dwarf. "I'm going to speak to Captain Carrot about this," said the third. "I never thought I'd live to see the day." Two of the dwarfs stormed off towards the locker room. Another one hurried after them, but hesitated as he drew level with the desk. He gave Cherry a frantic look. "Nice ankles, though," he said, and then ran. The fourth dwarf waited until the others had gone and then sidled up. Cherry was shaking with nervousness. "Don't you say a thing about my legs," she said, waving a finger. The dwarf looked around hurriedly and leaned forward. Is that lipstick?" "Yes, what about it?" The dwarf leaned forward even more, looked around again, this time conspiratorially, and lowered her voice. Could I try it?" Angua and Carrot walked silently through the fog, except for Angua's occasional crisp and brief directions. Then she stopped. Up until then, Dorful's scent, or at least the fresh scent of old meat and cow dung, had headed quite directly back to the slaughterhouse district. It's gone up this alley, she said. That's nearly doubling back, and it was moving faster, and there's a lot of humans, and sausages? Carrot started to run. A lot of people, and the smell of sausages meant a performance of the street theater that was life in Ankh-Morpork. There was a crowd further up the alley. It had obviously been there for some time, because at the rear was a familiar figure with a tray, craning to see over the tops of the heads. "What's going on, Mr. Dibbler?" said Carrot. "Oh, hello, Cap'n. They've got a golem." "Who have?" "Oh, some blokes. They've just fetched the hammers." There was a press of bodies in front of Carrot. He put both hands together and rammed them between a couple of people, and then moved them apart. Grunting and struggling, the crowd opened up like a watercourse in front of the better class of profit. Dorful was standing at bay at the end of the alley. Three men with hammers were approaching the golem cautiously. In the way of mobs, each unwilling to strike the first blow in case the second blow came right back at him. The golem was crouching back, shielding itself with its slate on which was written, "I am worth $530. "Money," said one of the men. "That's all you things think about." The slate shattered under a blow. Then he tried to raise his hammer again. When it didn't budge, he very nearly somersaulted backwards. "Money is all you can think about when all you have is a price," said Carrot, calmly, twisting the hammer out of his grip. "What do you think you're doing, my friend?" "You can't stop us," mumbled the man. "Everyone knows they're not alive." "But I can arrest you for willful damage of property," said Carrot. "One of these killed that old priest, sorry," said Carrot. "If it's just a thing, how can it commit murder? A sword is a thing." He drew his own sword and made an almost silken sound. "And of course you couldn't possibly blame a sword if someone thrust it at you, sir." The man went cross-eyed as he tried to focus on the sword. And again, Angua felt that touch of bewilderment. Carrot wasn't threatening the man. He wasn't threatening the man. He was merely using the sword to demonstrate a point. And that was all. He'd be quite amazed to hear that not everyone would think of it like that. Part of her said, "Someone has to be very complex indeed to be as simple as Carrot." The man swallowed. "Good point," he said. "Yeah, but you can't trust him," said one of the other hammer bearers. "They sneak around and they never say anything. What are they up to, eh?" He gave Dorful a kick. The golem rocked slightly. "Well now," said Carrot, "that is what I am finding out. In the meantime, I must ask you to go about your business." The third demolition man had only recently arrived in the city. He had gone along with the idea because there are some people who do. He raised his hammer defiantly and opened his mouth to say, "Oh yeah?" But stopped, because just by his ear he had heard a growl. It was quite low and soft, but it had a complex little waveform which went straight down into a little knobbly bit in his spinal column, where It pressed an ancient button marked Primal Terror. He turned. An attractive watchwoman behind him gave him a friendly smile. That was to say, her mouth turned up at the corners and all her teeth were visible. He dropped the hammer on his foot. "Well done," said Kara. "I've always said you can do more with a kind word and a smile." The crowd looked at him with the kind of expression people always wore when they looked at Carrot. It was the face-cracking realization that he really did believe what he was saying. The sheer enormity tended to leave people breathless. They backed away and scurried out of the alley. Carrot turned back to the golem, which had dropped to its knees and was trying to piece its slate together. "Come on, Dorful," he said. "I'll walk with you the rest of the way." "Are you mad?" said Sock, trying to shut the door. "You think I want that back?" "He's your property," said Carrot. "People were trying to smash him." "You should have let them," said the butcher. "Haven't you heard the stories? I'm not having one of those under my roof." He tried to slam the door again, but Carrot's foot was in it. "Then I'm afraid you're committing an offense," said Carrot. "To wit, littering." "Oh, be serious. I always am," said Carrot. "He always is," said Angua. Sock waved his hands frantically. "It can just go away. Shoo, I don't want a killer working in my slaughterhouse. You can have it, if you're so keen." Carrot grabbed the door and forced it wide open. Sock took a step backwards. "Are you trying to bribe an officer of the law, Mr. Sock? Are you insane?" "I am always sane," said Carrot. "He always is," sighed Angua. "Watchmen are not allowed to accept gifts," said Carrot. He looked around at Dorful, which was standing forlornly in the street. "But I will buy him from you, for a fair price." Sock looked from Carrot to the golem, and then back again. "Buy? For money? Yes." The butcher shrugged. "When people were offering you money, it was no time to debate their sanity." "Well, that's different," conceded. "It was worth $530 when I bought it. But of course it's got additional skills now," Angua growled. It had been a trying evening, and the smell of fresh meat was making her senses twang. "You were prepared to give it away a moment ago." "Well, give, yes, but business is business." "I'll pay you a dollar," said Carrot. "A dollar, that's daylight rough." Angua's hand shot out and grabbed the neck. She could feel the veins, smell the blood and fear. She tried to think of cabbages. "It's nighttime," she growled, "like the man in the alley." Sock listened to the call of the wild. "A dollar," he croaked. "Right. A fair price, $1. Carrot produced one and waved his notebook. "A receipt is very important," he said. "A proper legal transfer of ownership." "Right, right, right. Happy to oblige." Sock glanced desperately at Carrot Angua. Somehow, her smile didn't look right. He scribbled a few hasty lines. Carrot looked over his shoulder. "I, Gerhard Stock, give the bearer full and total ownership of the golem, Dorful, in exchange for $1, and anything it does now is his responsibility and nothing to do with me. Singed, Gerhard Stock." "Interesting wording, but it does look legal, doesn't it?" said Carrot, taking the paper. "Thank you very much, Mr. Sock. A happy solution all around, I feel." "Is that it? Can I go now?" "Certainly," and the door slammed shut. "Oh, well done," said Angua. "Now you own a golem. You do know that anything it does is your responsibility. If that's the truth, why are people smashing them? What are you going to use it for?" Carrot looked thoughtfully at Dorful, who was staring at the ground. "Dorful?" The golem looked up. "Here's your receipt. You don't have to have a master." The golem took the little scrap of paper between his thick fingers. "That means you belong to you," said Carrot, encouragingly. "You own yourself." Dorful shrugged. "What did you expect?" said Angua. "Did you think he was going to wave a flag?" "I don't think he understands," said Carrot. "It's quite hard to get some ideas into people's heads." He stopped abruptly. Carrot took the paper out of Dorful's unresisting fingers. "I suppose it might work," he said. "It seems a bit invasive, but what they understand, after all, is the words in their heads." He reached up, opened Dorful's lid, and dropped the paper inside. The golem blinked. That is to say, its eyes went dark and then brightened again. It raised one hand very slowly and patted the top of its head. Then it held up the other hand and turned it this way and that, as if it had never seen a hand before. It looked down at its feet and around at the fog-shrouded buildings. It looked at Carrot. It looked up at the clouds above the streets. It looked at Carrot again. Then, very slowly, without bending in any way, it fell backwards and hit the cobbles with a thud. The light faded in its eyes. "There," said Angua. "Now it's broken. Can we go?" "There's still a bit of a glow," said Carrot. "It must have all been too much for him. We can't leave him here. Maybe if I took the receipt out." He knelt down by the golem and reached for the trapdoor on its head. Dorful's hand moved so quickly it didn't even appear to move. It was just there, gripping Carrot's wrist. "Ah," said Carrot, gently pulling his arm back. "He's obviously feeling better." "Said Dorful. The voice of the golem shivered in the fog. Golems had a mouth. They were part of the design, but this one was open, revealing a thin line of red light. "Oh, ye gods," said Aang while backing away. "They can't speak." It was less a syllable than sound of escaping steam. "I'll find your bit of slate," Carrot began, looking around hurriedly. Dorful clambered to its feet, gently pushed him out of the way, and strode off. "Are you happy now?" "I'm not following that wretched thing. Maybe it's going to throw itself in the river." Carrot ran a few steps after the figure, and then stopped and came back. "Why do you hate them so much?" he said. "You wouldn't understand. I really think you wouldn't understand," said Angela. "It's an undead thing. They sort of throw in your face the fact you're not human. But you are human. 3 weeks out of 4. Can't you understand that? When you have to be careful all the time, it's dreadful to see things like that being accepted. They're not even alive, but they can walk around, and they never get people passing remarks about silver or garlic, up until now anyway. They're just machines for doing work." "That's how they're treated, exceptionally," said Carrot. "You're being reasonable again," snapped Angua. "You're deliberately seeing everyone's point of view. Can't you try to be unfair even once?"